Good morning, Dr.
Good
Sandy
morning.
Steingard. Thank you for joining me.
Sure. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. Would you mind with introducing yourself?
Sure. So I'm a psychiatrist. I work in Vermont. I've been involved in the public psychiatry sphere for a long time, basically the bulk of my career, which began in the 1980s. I'm a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Vermont Larner College of Medicine. I had been the chief medical officer at Howard Center, which is the community mental health center that serves Chittenden County, which is the largest county in Vermont, although not a super big place. And I retired from that job in 2020 and then took some time off. I'm now back doing clinical work and part-time. And my work has been focused on people who have diagnoses that fall into the psychosis category. And the nice thing about what I do now is because I've been at one place for so long, I came to the Howard Center in 1995, and I have people that I've worked with for decades. So kind of known them, know their families. I find that very rewarding work.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What got you interested in working with psychosis?
Well, that's a good question. I went into psychiatry to become a psychoanalyst. I was in medical school in the late 70s when in Boston, and psychoanalysis was still at that point. It was a transition time, but still a very predominant view. And that's how I was introduced to psychiatry. And I was a pretty unhappy medical student, very deeply ambivalent about some things in my life. And I thought psychoanalysis provided a very powerful sort of explanatory paradigm for, you know, personal understanding and understanding others. And so I did that and did a trained at a program that was very psychoanalytically oriented, and then became, I think, you know, my first turn to critical psychiatry, although I wouldn't have used this language, was becoming becoming disillusioned with some of psychoanalysis. So I had surprisingly found that the patients, the people I really found most interesting, were people experiencing psychosis. And also, I found the rest of psychiatry to be so murky, you know, how you define the category of depression, let's say, so broad and hard to kind of get your handle on. And psychosis was different. And, you know, at the time, the predominant views in the United States about psychosis was this is fundamentally a brain problem thought to be related to dopamine. And that, that felt to me like it fit more with psychosis. So it was a combination of really enjoying the work. I just find, and I still do find that experience of, you know, critical people might challenge that label, but, you know, altered states, altered realities to be deeply fascinating. So that's what got me into that. And to do that work in the United States, you're working in the public sector. So it was that curiosity that then drove me into public sector work.
Just curious, what is it that you led to you being disillusioned with the psychoanalytic space?
You know, the fundamental thing was that you couldn't disprove it. Okay, so if you say something to an analyst and they offer you an interpretation, you can say, oh, wow, thank you, that makes a lot of sense. You can object. Well, that objection can be seen as confirmation of, you know, that's some unconscious, it's whatever, it's some defense mechanisms, isn't that? And so, you know, as I delved into it, I thought it had problems with quality control. So I met not a lot of my friends became analysts. I was in one long psychodynamically oriented psychotherapy and then the psychoanalysis, and they were very different experiences. One was honestly kind of traumatizing and the other was great. And it was like, but they're both operating under these same principles. And then I would sit in class and people would come up with these interpretations that seemed to me kind of off the wall, and everyone say, yeah, you know, and it was like, how do you, you know, I think, you know, I've spent a lot, I kind of left it and I went to the University of Pittsburgh, which was a very different kind of place. And that's where I started doing psychosis work clinically and involved in some research. And but I've circled back in my evolution and thinking about how to think about psychosis and how do you think about the meanings of things, which I hadn't really spent a lot of time for a few decades thinking about, and then came back to it. And I've sort of reflected, like, have I come full circle now? Because now I try to pay more attention to that. And I don't think I have. I mean, we can get into, you know, the work that I've done, but I thought there was an arrogance at that time to the leaders of psychoanalysis, in the same way I think there's an arrogance in other areas of psychiatry, like the all-knowing expert and not being able to disprove them. So there was a book, Adolf Grunbaum is a very famous philosopher of psychiatry, and he wrote a book very critical of psychoanalysis, and I was a resident, and one of my colleagues, you know, was very interested in this and took it to our teachers, and I felt like they couldn't, I was very disappointed in their ability to engage in it in a meaningful way. And, you know, even as a resident, if you object too much to what's going on, that's seen as a sign of your psychopathology. And that failure to really engage got replicated again in other areas of psychiatry. So that was kind of the germ of my critical approach. And it helped me because I think I could see how all the different frames we have are these paradigms, they're hypotheses that are imposed upon the distress of people we see, as opposed to just sort of saying, this is how it is. So I think it's one area that being so old has been helpful, because I've lived through these shifts. So it helps me understand, oh, it's just a shift. It's just you know, not that a paradigm is bad, but there's a difference between seeing something as like a paradigm, a hypothesis, a way of thinking versus the way it is. You know, this is what it is, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. That was fun. Thanks. I'm interested in psychoanalysis, and I've interviewed like Jungians and more classically oriented psychoanalysts. So I was just curious to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, no, I listened to one of your podcasts with a Jungian, which I found pretty interesting. But
I wonder how, I wonder what that space is like these days, if it still has kind of that. I would imagine in the 70s, when the psychoanalysts lost a lot of their prominence and the DSM changed over, and I wonder if that kind of struck some humility into a lot of them. And so, I don't know.
You know, I mean, one of my messages about psychiatrists to be humble. So it would be really unhumble for me to opine about the state of modern psychoanalysis, because I don't know. And I don't walk in those corridors, and not to any sort of meaningful way. But I think what's really interesting is how it has survived. And there's something there. And I think, like, more recently, I've gotten interested in something called open dialogue, and which really refrains from interpretation. And in doing that work, and this I started in like 2012, so I left my psychoanalytic training in 1987 or 8, and so that's a long time. And yet, what I learned in doing that is how deeply entrenched interpretation was in my thinking, in my thinking about people, in my thinking about everything. It was really deeply in there. So, is that a good thing or a bad thing? I don't know, but I have to say I think it's interesting that it's endured despite, you know, everything that's changed within the field of psychiatry.
Yeah. So that kind of sparked your critical attitude, mindset, whatever we want to, and then finishing out your let's say, degree, and then going into the beginning, being like an early careerist psychiatrist. What was that like for you?
Well, as I mentioned, I went to the University of Pittsburgh, which is a large research institution, and it was kind of like a second residency for me. I was a junior faculty member, and they have a big hospital, and they divide the units of the hospital by diagnosis. So I elected at that point to work on what was called the schizophrenia unit, inpatient unit. There was a depression unit and different things like that. And again, that was just born out of, I had left psychoanalysis. I really didn't know what I wanted to do in psychiatry. And I went there with my partner. So I wouldn't have gone on my own. And it was fascinating. I mean, I loved it. I was there for 5 years and I learned about clinical research and I learned about, just a whole different approach to the field than I had been exposed to in my training. And it was fascinating. And then I left again because, well, my partner thought he wanted to do like academic work and sort of decided, at least for a while, he didn't want to. And we landed in Vermont just because it was a nice place to live. We had young kids. And that landed me because I was still very interested in psychosis. And so I worked at the state hospital in Vermont. But the next swing in my, and I've been really lucky. I mean, I've been fortunate in terms of being able to find jobs that interest me. I at the time was a working mom. And so being able to have a balance with my young kids was very important to me. I didn't stick with academic psychiatry because I didn't see a way to balance that with raising children. So I was glad to be able to find a clinical job that I found rewarding. So in that way, I consider myself, I know I'm a very privileged person, privileged by in multiple ways, but I was very lucky in that way. But what happened in the 90s was there was a second wave of introduction of new psychiatric drugs. And I was excited about that. So I was in Pittsburgh when clozapine was remarketed. So I saw that. And it was nice to be in an academic place when that was being used. Pittsburgh had been one of the sites for the multi-center study that allowed clozapine, which is a drug for people who have psychosis who've not responded to the traditional antipsychotics. But I also knew how terrible the first wave of antipsychotics were in terms of tolerability and problems. But the other thing that happened is I participated in a study in Pittsburgh that was called the Neuroleptic Threshold Study, which was testing whether very low doses of haloperidol, an older traditional antipsychotic, were as effective as higher doses. And it was a really good study, and it demonstrated that what were considered very minor low dose of haloperidol were as effective. And I was like, really schooled. And the leading academic psychopharmacologists in schizophrenia were all about minimized dose. People were worried about tardive dyskinesia, worried about the side effects. And so that's like the mindset that I came out, be careful, be cautious, and I knew the literature on that. And then what happened is the new wave. So I'm talking about, olanzapine marketed as Zyprexa, risperidone marketed as risperidol, and a few more came out during that decade. And I was excited. I gave one drug talk in my career, and it was a drug talk on Zyprexa. And I'll tell you, I felt like I needed to take a shower afterwards because, I was given a slide set, and I thought this was, I was excited that this drug was coming out because I saw how difficult it was for people to take drugs like haloperidol. There were moms from NAMI in the audience. Everybody's so open. And I just felt like there's something that wasn't right about this. I felt like I was a mouthpiece and I never did it again. But what I saw over the next decade was leaders of my field were the mouthpieces. So what would happen is, there's academic papers in, let's say, the American Journal of Psychiatry or what's now called JAMA Psychiatry. And those are peer-reviewed, sort of rigorous studies. But then I would get, and you know, this is pre-email, it was very early email days, newspapers. And one like you and I, before starting the podcast, we're talking about Psychiatric Times, there was a Clinical Psychiatry News, and there would be papers in there. And then there would be leaflets that would just show up in my mailbox. These were promotional. A lot of this was promotional, and the people writing them were the same academics writing for the, you know, the academic journals, but they were distorting the literature. And I would read the studies that allowed for these drugs to become marketed and see that what was being promoted was different. So I'll give you an example, two examples. One is risperidone. So the idea was, you know, it was initially marketed as having less extrapyramidal side effects, Parkinsonian side effects, stiffness, tremor, than haloperidol. But when you looked at it, it was compared to a very high dose of haloperidol, 20 milligrams a day. Now, in the neuroleptic threshold study I'd done, we found that 3.5 milligrams of haloperidol were just as effective as 5, 10, 20. 20 is a really, really high dose of haloperidol. You can guarantee someone's going to have a lot of Parkinsonian side effects. So if you're comparing risperidone to haloperidol 20 milligrams and saying this is an advance because it doesn't cause as much extra, you know, much Parkinsonian symptoms, that's not really a breakthrough. They didn't compare it to, you know, equivalent doses. And now if you go and look up charts, they have charts on like dose comparisons. Risperidone is considered dose equivalent to haloperidol. So a true study would have been to compare dose equivalents and see if something was different. And quite honestly, I don't think there would have been a difference, with perhaps the idea that risperidone causes prolactin, a hormone that can lead to secretion, lactation, in men and women, and breast development in men and women. Risperidone may do this more than haloperidol. Haloperidol does it, but risperidone doesn't. There was a big lawsuit, you know, for young boys who developed breast tissue. And so I'm not even sure these are advanced, you know, that there's a real advantage. And yet it got lost, and it was marketed as more effective and more better tolerated. And so that's number one. Number two was olanzapine and weight gain. So olanzapine, I was struck that people tolerated this drug better than they did the older drugs. People didn't complain as much. People liked it in my patient. But I would notice within a year, I knew people were gaining weight. And I got a scale, and I put a scale in my office. It was like 1997. And I've learned from this, like if you see someone, you know, say, oh, you know, he's put on some weight. It's usually like 20, 30 pounds. I learned that because I was weighing people, and it was not uncommon for people to put on 20, 30, if not more pounds of weight being on this drug. But what happened in the literature, in the academic literature, was a debate. Well, it's not really worse than risperidone. It's not really worse than the older antipsychotics, or schizophrenia itself is associated with weight gain. This was the argument until finally, in like the early 2000s, there was a big study funded by NIMH. And yeah, lo and behold, you know, they all cause weight gain, olanzapine doing it a bit more than the others. You know, clozapine we know causes weight gain. So it was that kind of, I thought, dishonesty and sort of hiding behind things. And it was being done by leaders in my field. And that was when, that was really the big shift for me. And there were people writing papers about this. One person who I think was really courageous is Marcia Angel. She was the first woman editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, which is a very prominent, storied medical journal, you know, in the United States, if not worldwide. So she was in a very respectable position, and she started writing papers. There was one in the New York Review of Books. The New Republic, a magazine back in the days when we had magazines. And she wrote it with her her husband, Arnold Relman, who had been a previous editor. So these are very, you know, serious leaders of the field. And, you know, she wrote about what was happening with the drug companies and paying ghostwriters. And then she published a book probably like early aughts called The Truth About the Drug Companies. And that had a, you know, that was really important. Then I started reading heavily about this, and there were a lot of journalists writing about this. You know, people covered the whole stuff with opiates and Purdue Pharmaceutical way before it got the kind of attention that it got now. This is not, and that story is not, it's not unique to opiates. It was happening all over medicine. And so, yeah, I mean, that had a big effect on me. And then I picked up this book called Anatomy of an Epidemic by another journalist, Robert Whitaker. And I read that in 2011. And it's interesting because Marcia Angel was invited to give the graduation speech at UVM College of Medicine that year. And I was fortunate enough to be invited to meet her. And she was writing her review of this book. I hadn't quite got through it yet. And, you know, her review had, you know, was got a lot of attention. She got a lot of blowback for it. But that book, in that book, Robert Whitaker raises another issue. And the issue is whether long-term use of these drugs really improved outcome. And with psychosis, the recommendation is to continue them indefinitely because it reduces relapse. And then there's an assumption that reducing relapse would improve outcome. And he raised a very provocative and serious question and suggested that maybe they worsen outcome. And I thought the book was important, and he's a journalist. He's not a clinician, but when he covered our papers that I knew, I thought he covered them accurately. And then there were a lot of papers I wasn't familiar with. So that led me to a bunch of things. I basically deconstructed everything I knew and went back and found the primary literature and spent quite a bit of time, reading it to determine for myself whether I agreed with him. And I also started contacting colleagues. And I mentioned how I was disappointed with the response of colleagues when another resident brought up Adolf Grunbaum's book about psychoanalysis. And I was equally disappointed by the response of colleagues when I started to raise these questions. And it wasn't raising them saying, like, he's right. It's raising them like, what do you think? What I found most people did was they read his first chapter, which said, if all these drugs are so great, why are we seeing rising rates of psychiatric disability, right? That's, and people would say, that's correlation. It's not causation. There's a lot of things changing in our culture that could account for that. I agree. The thing is, the rest of the book, you know, that was a jumping off point to say, I want to investigate this. And the rest of the book is where the meat of the argument is. And I had a hard time getting people to really, I thought, deeply engage, I mean, in this, and then, you know, getting criticism. But anyway, I ended up meeting Whitaker, and he started his website, Man America, invited me to blog, and I started blogging on that, and meeting a lot of people from the community of people who have taken these drugs and been harmed by them and trying to engage with them in a meaningful way. But the other thing that happened is that at the end of the book, he talks about alternatives and he mentions open dialogue. And I was in a very fortunate position. A lot of things aligned. And so I was able to start to study open dialogue and then work with some colleagues in Vermont to try to implement at least some of the principles of open dialogue. And and then I also started to work on tapering antipsychotics with people I work with. So that's sort of the story, the arc of my career.
Yeah. I saw an article from 2017, maybe 18, the 5-year outcomes of tapering antipsychotic drug doses in a community mental health center. Is that you implementing open dialogue?
So, you know, what happened is, I read the book. I spent about, you know, a year or so, like really going back over this stuff and then thinking, you know, I think there's something to this. So I felt compelled, like, what is medicine? What is the practice of medicine? It's a lot of it is informed consent. You have an expert, you have expert knowledge, and then you bring that to the person you're working with and talk to them and try to tell them what you know and come up with sort of a collaborative approach. And I felt like I could not sit on this, that I needed to bring it up. But I also knew that if I did this, I would remember the places where it went awry. Like, you know, your memory gets distorted. Another person that's really influenced me is Daniel Kahneman, who writes about, you know, cognitive bias. And that was another book that was like swirling around in my head. So I wanted to try to track what was going on so that I could reflect back and see what the outcomes were. So this wasn't a research study in terms of informed consent. It really ultimately was a chart review. But I approach people in sort of a consistent way. And the approach was to say, look, I read this book. You know, just what I told you. This is a journalist. He's not a clinician. But I've gone back. I've looked at the literature. And it makes me wonder whether it serves you to be on the drugs you're on. Now, I talked about the neuroleptic threshold study. And I think I had always had a conservative bent to the drugs. And what I'd seen as the outgrowth of all this marketing from the 2000s and aughts was a kind of promiscuity about medicine. So people would end up on multiple medications and then on doses that I wasn't sure were needed. And if people were complaining, then yeah, I would lower the dose. I was always doing that. But there were a lot of people who weren't really complaining. And it's like, what do you do? Because I also was familiar with the relapse data. And I knew that statistically there was a higher rate of relapse. And I didn't want to expose people to harm. And, you know, the approach I take is a harm reduction, really, because, you know, there's a potential harm to reducing your medications, but there's also a harm to staying on them. And even if Whitaker wasn't right about the sort of long-term disability, we knew about weight gain. I mean, there are a lot of reasons to say you should be on as little of these drugs as possible. So I had this discussion with people. The only people I excluded were people who could not engage in a conversation. You know, some people, I did not judge that. And this is clinical practice. It's what clinical practice is. I don't feel like we're able to engage in a meaningful conversation, but many people were. And I just kept track, like who wants to try reduction and who says no, thank you. And I ended up tracking about, I haven't looked at the study recently, like it was like 70 people. And then how did I taper? I would taper very, very slowly. And because the relapse literature would look at people, some of the studies went over 2 years, but when you would see a relapse, it was usually like 3 to 6 months. So I would not make reductions any more frequently than 3 months. And depending on the person, depending on the risk, we might spread it out, depending what the person wanted. And so I followed people and looked at 5-year outcomes. And I'll tell you, you know, this is a limited study, but, you know, I had the data. And I wanted to get it out there because no one was doing this. You know, a lot more has been done now. And the big thing that I found is that my patients were, if anything, more conservative than I was. So like one big critique of Bob Whitaker and his book was like, everybody's going to stop their drugs. I had a colleague in Vermont once tell me that I was responsible for the increased rate of assaults on staff at one of our psychiatric facilities, which is a very damning thing to say. Yeah. And the idea was Vermont's a small state. I was doing, you know, I was blogging, people knew me, and I don't know, people must have said, you know, people didn't want to take the drug, something about me, like justifying it. But the thing is, within psychiatry, there have been people for as long as, you know, there have been mental hospitals who don't think they're ill, who don't think they have a problem, who don't want any kind of treatment, who, you know, don't like the medications. That's exist. Okay. And I don't think that what I say really, maybe it bolsters it, but I don't think it, I've not met someone who picks up Robert Whitaker and suddenly doesn't want to be on the drugs. Most of my patients were very cautious. They were worried. They understood relapse rate, and a whole bunch of them said, no, thank you. I don't want to do anything. And even among the monks that wanted us taper, people would stop. Maybe they'd start again. Maybe they'd stop, go back up. You know, it was a very collaborative thing. There wasn't, because this wasn't a research paper, there wasn't really a protocol. It was a collaborative process. And I think that's a valuable finding because it counters this notion that I see again and again and again. You got to be careful in how you talk about the harms of these drugs, because it's going to, just talking about harms is going to harm people. It's come up with the SSRIs. You know, early on, there was concern that there were certain people who might be more prone to actions, dangerous actions, suicidal actions. And it was, there was a case report written by a Harvard psychiatrist, and I think it was published in the American Journal of Psychiatry, and it got largely criticized. Like, this is terrible. Now people aren't going to want to take these drugs. And I think that's a problematic response. Because it buries harms.
Yeah. So, the 5-year outcomes of the people who did want to taper off.
Yeah.
What can you tell us the results?
Yeah. I mean, it's embarrassing that I haven't looked at the paper in a while. So,
I put you on the spot.
I may need to, like, we could halt the podcast and I can review it. I mean, basically I looked at hospitalization rates, and I looked at working employment, because the hypothesis in the Whitaker book was that, you know, there's more impairment in recovery, you know, employment, friendships. It's hard to measure that, but I thought I would look at the rate of employment, and I found no differences. There were only like 7 people who were in the hospital, you know, of the group that tapered. And so it wasn't, you know, there were some hospitalizations, but it wasn't a super high rate. As I said, it was modest. And, so like I don't take from my paper some robust finding that says, oh, if you taper people, you're going to see improved, you know, recovery, improved employment. I think it did say you can engage with people in a meaningful way and talk about tapering and not have, you know, disastrous outcomes. Although there were some people who did end up in the hospital. A lot of those are people who ended up in the hospital anyway. It happened, or they, one thing that I learned about, was that I would have a person and we would have like a really collaborative relationship, and I would, you know, I would go slowly. And I've learned even more since then that when you really want to slow down is at the very end of the taper, that a lot of the receptor occupancy is occurring at very low doses that are thought to be subtherapeutic. And although I didn't know it at the time, I was still pretty cautious when I got down to those lower doses, because in my mind, I was thinking, well, the risk of the drug is shifting as you lower the dose. Like the risk of being on it is shifting, right? Because you're reducing all the side effects of these drugs are dose related. And, but the risk of relapse is still there. So as you go down to these ultra low doses, and you continue to be worried about relapse, but your worry about side effects, bad effects, has greatly diminished. Let's say if someone's on, you've reduced the dose by 75%. So I become more cautious. And I had a few people that on those very low doses stopped abruptly and didn't do well. And so, but all of a sudden there was the collaborative relationship we had seemed to kind of fall apart. And that was pretty distressing to see. And I don't have a great answer to that. And it's hard to know how to predict it. So I don't minimize the risk of relapse. It's what I do, you know, what my work is. I see this happening, but I still feel like we discount the many, many people who can engage in a thoughtful conversation and that the alliance stays robust. And, you know, I still see the people that came off and relapsed and what's happened. And, I can't really talk about individual cases because of confidentiality, but, you know, people tend to, you know, things can work out over time. And, you know, the problem with, the research is that it's rare to have a 2-year outcome study, yet people are on these drugs for decades. And it's kind of unknown territory, but I feel pretty good about the fact that I've been able to help people get to much reduced doses of medicines. I don't always, I mean, if people want to come off, I will support them with it, but I tend to want to slow things down when we get to low doses.
Thinking about, so you work mainly in well, first, let me just say, I think it's pretty neat that you're in the position that you were in, to where you read about all of this, you read Anatomy of an Epidemic, and you're in a position to be basically, let's try it out. Let's talk with these people, give them some informed consent about what I'm learning, what I'm reading, and then let's kind of like put it to the test and see what happens, as long as they're comfortable with that. And I think for, you know, for someone like me, I'm trying to better understand all of this stuff, but I don't really have any say so over anything when it comes to medications. I work in an interdisciplinary setting, and sometimes I might see someone who's on 4 or 5 different medications, and I'm doing therapy for them to help them. Maybe their goals are to have more energy and to feel happy again. And I'm wondering how much of this medication is getting in the way of them having more energy. You know what I mean? And there's not much that I can talk with them about and hypothesize about and gauge their interest. So I think it's pretty neat that you were in that position to where you could do something with the information that you were gathering. But even with that, it sounds like there for a while you would have related to that feeling of maybe a disconnect between maybe what you're thinking and learning versus how you practice or how the people around you are practicing. And when you go to them for their thoughts, they don't really have a whole lot of in-depth thoughts on the matter.
Yeah. Is there a question, or you're just commenting on what was?
I guess, can you, was there a particular time in your career where it was like you felt maybe incongruent or hesitant about the way that you had to practice?
Well, yeah. I mean, first of all, thank you. And secondly, I just lost my AirPod. I was very lucky because I had been working. Well, I'd been in Vermont since 1993, and I had been working at this one agency since 1995. And I read Anatomy of an Epidemic in 2011. Now, people already knew about some of my critical stances. So, for instance, I became the medical director in 2002, and the first thing I did was to ban drug reps and drug rep paraphernalia from the agency. I wrote a policy about this, and it took a lot of explaining on why this was a problem, because, you know, we had, you know, other colleagues the agency, community mental health centers are largely social service agencies with a couple of doctors thrown in, which I love. That's why I value what they do, and I love my colleagues, but they weren't, you know, they were saying, why does Sandy not want us to have these pens? Or why does Sandy not want us to have these clocks, you know, that has Zyprexa on it? And I did. I went out and bought a bunch of pens. And I said, there was like a pen return. Give me your pens. And I did a lot of education to say, you know, this is advertising. I don't think we should be in the business of advertising. I don't think we should be getting their bagels. I mean, I had one incident where I brought a drug rep to tears because this was before I was medical director, and she brought bagels, and she put them in the reception area and I put them in the waiting room. And my point was, look, if you're going to bring bagels to the agency, we might as well give them to the people that are eating your drugs. And it's like, well, no, it was a gift for the staff. I said, the staff can walk out of the reception area and pick up a bagel, but our clients can't walk into the reception area. It's a locked door. And we went back and forth, and then, you know, she was crying. And was like, anyway, so when people knew me, you know, I wasn't shy about this. And the first thing I did was that. But then I pick up anatomy, and there it's sort of shifting prescribing. And, you know, there's a liability, right? If you do something and someone has a psychotic episode and gets in the hospital, or does something to themselves or other people, which does happen, is it, you know, am I responsible? And is there a medical liability? And there's a standard of accepted community practice. And so, you know, I needed to be pretty careful about that. But I thought, you know, I think it all falls in with standard medicine. Doctors don't always agree. And so if you explain the principles of medical practice, you explain the risks and benefits, informed consent. And you say, there is a risk. This is a risk. This is a risk of staying on. And this is what I know. This is what I don't know. I would even say to people, you know what, if there was another psychiatrist in the room, that psychiatrist might say this. What I'm doing is not what everyone agrees with. So I want you to be aware of that. I would bring family members in. I think that's standard practice. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything all that radical about it, you know, but I thought I had a moral obligation to share this. I didn't want to, you know, I did the thought experiment. What if like 10 years down the road, someone comes in and says, you know, I picked up this book and, you know, what do you think about that? And I said, yeah, you know, I think there's something to it, but I like didn't feel like bringing it up, you know, that's so, you know, I was lucky to work in an agency and I was very open. I also started writing a blog on Man America around the same time. So it was all out there what I was doing. Not, you know, I didn't ever talk about individual patients, but it was my idea and how I was approaching this. And I said, you know, you need to know this. It might be controversial. And I was very supportive. I think I had a certain kind of social capital because I'd been there at this point a long time. And I think people thought, well, in person, I seem like a credible human being, you know, and, you know, and I was a hard worker and I was conscientious. I think, you know, it's embarrassing. I mean, I think that's what people would say. And so, like, I think people had enough sort of faith in me. I mean, it could also just be that they were stuck with me because it's hard to find psychiatrists. We had had some turnover. Whatever it was, I did talk to a number of colleagues at the time that were in other places and were not in a position of authority, and they felt really criticized and shut down and unable to practice the way they wanted to. And, you know, you know, I've been a very, I mean, this was not fun for me. Blogging, I was in a lot of distress. I felt, I really, and I still wonder, you know, if you look back on your career, have you done more good than harm, more harm than good? And so I was in a lot of turmoil. But at the same time, I recognize, you know, my privilege in on many, many levels, and the privilege of being able to write a blog, you know. So I'm very grateful to Robert Whittaker. Although I told him I wish I never picked up his book because my life got so complicated.
Yeah.
In the end, I'm very grateful.
I think one of the things that I haven't really explored yet on this channel is some of the stuff you've mentioned today about the drug reps, the drug talks that psychiatrists give, ghostwriters, things like that. And if I could summarize some of the things that you've said, you've mentioned. So one, here in America, we have all of these different, whether it be antidepressants or antipsychotics or what, mood stabilizers, they're all advertised on TV. And then you have drug reps that go into different psychiatric offices or hospitals and advertise their drugs. And then you have psychiatrists who get paid to do drug talks at conferences and things like that. It sounds like you mentioned some of the head psychiatrists in the field were perhaps being paid to do drug talks and were writing articles in scientific journals about the efficacy or almost like promoting certain drugs for certain. So you have a lot of the pharmaceutical industry and psychiatrists kind of working collaboratively, which can kind of, you know, bias views. Is that kind of, am I summing up pretty well?
Yeah. And I mean, the problem, it's such an interesting story, of like, you know, a lot of it was unintended consequences. And I think that's why some psychiatrists get offended, because like they're working hard and they, you know, but you know, the FDA gave prescribing privileges to physicians not really that long ago. And, I mean, it may have been the '50s or earlier, but at any point, the time at which prescribing privileges went to physicians was to say, these are learned men, and at the time it was mostly men, but these are learned people, and their knowledge is going to help them to not get pulled into marketing, because there's always been marketing from the pharmaceutical companies, right? And so, you know, this is better than, you know, people. Now, so doctors have a lot of control over what people get, and this gets played out in ways that we don't always really think about the consequences of it. But what then in the early 60s, the FDA required drug companies to have a particular target. That was a response to the thalidomide. Scared thalidomide was given to women in early pregnancy, and children were born with horrific birth defects. So up until then, they drug companies needed to demonstrate safety, but then they required them to have particular targets. This coincides with all these new psych drugs coming on the market in the 50s and 60s, with the rise of the sort of phenomenological, biological arm of psychiatry, where the DSM is getting revised to be more consistent and, you know, clear symptoms and signs and this kind of thing. And that culminates in 1980 with the DSM-3 coming out. And so now there's all these like more clarified entities, you know, that aligns with what the drug companies need, because they need a drug target, right? You have, you know, I'm going to market this drug to treat schizophrenia. I'm going to market this drug to treat major depressive disorder, right? And then you have a drugs on a patent. And if the patent, when the patent expires, the drug company is going to lose money. So there's a few things that will enhance drug company making money. One would be to have more targets. So, okay, your drug was initially approved for this. Now we're going to approve it for X. So you do another study, and then to have more people. So if you have something like schizophrenia that affects, let's say, 1% of the population, but you can demonstrate somehow that it's, this drug is effective for depression, which affects 15 to 20% of the population, you can see how you now have a lot more people. Plus you've now extended your patent life. It's a lot of money to be made. Or you say people need these drugs indefinitely. So rather than be on them, when I was trained with antidepressants, we were told 6 to 9 months, and then you stop it. And then the field shifted and people looked at relapse, and then people have to be on this for the rest of their lives. So there's all these confluences. Now you can say, this is good. This is advancement in science. We're helping, we're expanding all the people that we can help. But, and doctors are scientists, you know, they're going to be influenced by the data. They're not going to be influenced by marketing. But, you know, there've been a lot of work, and Marcia Angel being someone I've alluded to say, doctors are humans. Bias, cognitive bias affects everybody. And we're all subject to these kinds of influences. And I think we've seen it play out. We've seen it play out again and again and again. I think I mentioned since we started talking opiates and Purdue Pharmaceutical, that's gotten a lot of attention. And, you know, the way they did it, the way they brought doctors in, and the way they promoted the fifth vital sign of pain, and the way they promoted that these drugs are not addicted. And it's a terrible story, and a lot of people have died, but it is not a unique story. I mean, one of the things that kind of upsets me about it is that people have not used that story to then look systematically at the field of medicine to see how this was just business as usual. That happened to be in the business of a particularly toxic group of drugs, and so it's serious. We need to pay attention, but it's not unique to that drug, and we saw it playing out. And I think there was a naivety among physicians. You know, if I'm smart, I'm not going to be influenced by bias. I mentioned Dan Kahneman's book that he wrote, which summarized all the work that he had done, and it's Thinking Fast and Slow, one of the best books I've ever read. And then I started reading a lot about that. What that demonstrated is like IQ does not protect you from bias. And people need to be educated about that, because, you know, they get offended if you say, I think you're biased. So you know what? If you go to the drug lunch, you get biased. You do get biased, and you see it. I mean, I still see it playing out. I mean, I can give you well, I can go on and on, as you see, but I think it's a huge story, and I think it continues to be a huge story. You know, the difference in psychiatry is they don't really have new drugs. You know, the new drugs are old drugs. You know, there's a lot of attention now on the hallucinogens and that kind of stuff. But with schizophrenia, the big thing is on these injectable drugs, and they're getting a lot of play. And they're not a new concept, but they're getting a lot of play now because the newer antipsychotics are now available in those forms. Those are still on patent, and you see them being promoted heavily. And it's just, I think it's driven in the same way, and in a way that's not acknowledged.
Yeah. And talking about biases, I came into psychology, not psychiatry, for a reason, right? Like, I already had this kind of bias. I like psychoanalysis. I like more of the psychological view of things than I do the biological view of things. So I already know that I have that bias. And then, so I also know that arguments like, you know, from, arguments for like Anatomy of an Epidemic or Moncrief, Dr. Moncrief, or any, I know I'm going to naturally tend to those arguments better, more likely. So I'm trying to, a lot of what I've been trying to do with these different interviews is try to figure out, where does my bias begin and end? And where is the nuance? There's the approach that, you know, these medications are the best thing ever. And then I would never use a single psychiatric medication, no matter the circumstance. And then everything in between. So I'm trying to find it sounds like talking with Dr. Moncrief, she was, and you've talked about this too, I know, the drug-centered approach, where it's not that there is a known biological reason for the presentation of this mental illness, and the drugs that we're using are not targeting a known biological etiology, but these drugs do have certain effects, whether they're stimulants or sedatives or whatever that might be. And can we use these drugs to help this person therapeutically, at least for now or for a while, versus it's not a cure from a known etiology? And I like that type of thinking. And I guess that's what I was going to ask you more about is when it comes to, you get to work a lot with psychosis, and it's a lot more, I think that the effects of some of those psychiatric drugs on the symptom presentation of psychosis is a lot more apparent than perhaps antidepressants are on depression. So you have kind of that protective safeguard where it's like, oh, I know that there's something. So, but can you talk a little bit about the effectiveness of antipsychotics versus something like antidepressants?
Well, you know, you hit on something that is really interesting, and it made it, I had a lot harder time, adopting a drug-centered approach with the antipsychotic drugs. So let me just say, Dr. Moncrief has had a big influence on me, and that's how I find thinking about a drug-centered approach, talking to patients in a drug-centered way, enormously helpful, and is really the thing that sort of helped me to make sense of what I was doing. And, you know, there's some areas of disagreement that we can come back to, but it has to do with, like, does it matter that we don't know what these conditions are? Does that completely discount them or not? And I think that there are areas where Dr. Moncrief and I may not agree, but to me, that's a intellectual discussion. And I know people that, I know that some people think that's really important to be conceptually clear, and that's fine. But in terms of, like, talking to people, to me, it's a very different conversation to say, this, you have a condition that's called schizophrenia. This is a drug that treats schizophrenia. And you need to stay on it, because if you stop it, this schizophrenia is going to come back. And now then to say you're having a lot of intense thoughts, voices right now, and they're really bombarding you. They seem unpleasant, you know, and this is a drug that may dampen those experiences to give you mental space to be able to think about other things, to maybe be able to take care of yourself better, to give you some relief. And, you know, that's what I think this drug does. And so let's try it and see. Now, on the other hand, it's dampening down a lot of things. You know, it's not just dampening voices. It may be dampening other things. It may be like dampening your get up and go. So we need to pay attention to that. And if we see that, rather than assume you're not wanting to work, or you're not wanting to get out of bed, or you're not wanting to take a shower, is due to this thing that we call schizophrenia, which is the disease-centered model, to say, you know, at least in part, this could be from this drug, because we know that's what that drug does. You know, if you give it to normal, that's a terrible word, but if you give it to people who aren't experienced psychosis, just to see what the psychoactive effects are, you see some sedation, some, you know, lack of get up and go. So, you know, so let's talk about it that way. And then when you're on it and things are improving, you know, let's try to get it down to the point that is manageable, because maybe then we can talk about the voices and what you're hearing. And are there other strategies in addition to the drug that it might help you to manage them? So that was it. That process, what I just described, took me a long time, because, you know, when I first read the book, well, first of all, I think most people think about benzodiazepines in a drug-centered way, but, you know, or they code switch. Like, they might talk about it as treatment for panic attack, but then say, well, we know it. Everybody takes, you know, everybody has a response when they take benzodiazepines. Everybody can get, is at risk for addiction or dependence and that kind of thing. But they're useful for panic attack. And so it sort of smoothed out that difference. But it wasn't that hard for me to get to them, even with like SSRIs, which are like, they're different from, let's say, speed, that gives you like an immediate euphoria. You know, the SSRI antidepressants don't really give that, but I do think it's a different kind of numbing, a different quality of numbing. But it was harder for me for the antipsychotics, but then it all of a sudden made sense when I went back and sort of thought about it, like, what does it do to people that aren't psychotic? And, you know, and it now makes a lot of sense. I think that's a very different conversation, the conversation from a drug-centered point of view, because the risk of the disease-centered approach is a loss of agency. People are waiting for some external, well, two things. The people that buy into what you're saying then become, it feeds into a kind of passivity, waiting for some external help. And I think that in all flavors of recovery, you want to find a way of bolstering agency, not blaming people who don't get better. That's a different kind of thing. But to say, let's try to preserve who you are, your umph, what you want in life, and to be cautious with a drug that might dampen that, to pay attention to that. And then the other thing is, we know that these drugs, and we've known it for a long time, alter the brain, alter the dopamine receptors. Then, and when you stop them, it's going to be a different brain than when you start them. And so there may be something to withdrawal versus just assuming anything you're seeing is this underlying condition. This has been known, this has been written about since the 70s, largely ignored. You know, there's something called supersensitivity psychosis. And the drug-centered approach keeps it in your mind as a clinician, at least thinks about it. You know, the medical model is a process of looking at, you know, the complaints a person has, any signs of kind of the condition being problem, and then formulating what's called a differential diagnosis. It could be A, it could be B, it could be C. Based on that, we may do further evaluation, or we may try something and see what's going on. What I would argue, what I would say to my colleagues, keep in the differential diagnosis when you stop the drugs, that it's withdrawal. It could be relapse, it could be withdrawal. I think it's very, very hard sometimes to see the difference. Keep that in mind and at least operate with the possibility that withdrawal could occur because it's going to shape how you take people off the drugs. I mean, we've not studied how we take people off these drugs. It's just been ignored. And that's because we've taken this disease-centered approach and been pretty comfortable ascribing almost all the problems people have when they stop them to relapse and not really paying attention to withdrawal, even though people have been talking about this since the 80s, early 90s, with some drugs, not all of them. So, yeah, so that's what I say. And you know, it is also why I get very cautious at the lower doses, because, again, the harm, risk-harm equation tends to shift as you go down.
Hmm.
So,
yeah.
I feel like maybe I've gotten off track from
question. Yeah, that was helpful. Would you say, maybe like two or three questions here, kind of wrapping. Would you say that if you were treating someone with something like a major depressive disorder, would you say that, and maybe it's more on the, you know, moderate to severe end of things. They're pretty clinically depressed, right? Would your informed consent look a lot of the same? Would you feel comfortable prescribing something? And then if you did, would you try to keep it, like you said, 6 to 9 months, like you were taught in the early days?
Yeah, well, let me just say a few things. I don't even like the term clinical depression. No, okay. No offense. I think that this is what we have to be wary about. You know, we have this constructed diagnosis in the DSM called major depressive disorder. And I think it's quite broad. You know, I think I think a lot of people can fall under that at, you know, at different times. And then we have these studies showing efficacy for the antidepressant drugs. And I'm going to talk about the newer ones. I think that they're not nearly as robust as is commonly thought. If you look at them, if you look at the placebo response rate, you know, I'm definitely in, you know, this is a controversial take. But I think they've been so highly promoted that there's a sense in the culture that, you know, they're super effective. And I just don't think the data supports that. So for me, that's what the informed consent is, and not so much, you know, getting into the gradations of things, or can you identify a cause? I mean, I think another muddied kind of conceptual thing is like, if you can find a cause, then it deserves psychological treatment. And if it comes out of the blue, it's biological. And I think that's a false thing. We just don't know what brings these on. And probably in the vast majority of people, it's some sort of complex iteration of things. And so in the end, we're just talking about a collection of experiences that someone's having and saying, yes, you meet the criteria for this condition, what we call this thing. And these drugs have been found to be effective in a certain number of people. And then you see if someone wants to start it. And then, yeah, when you stop it, I again would say, you know, this is what the data is, but I would go down slowly because, you know, there's Mark Horowitz is a psychiatrist that's written a lot about this and has talked about the receptor binding. And a lot of the receptor binding is happening at these very, very low doses. It's hard to do because you can't even get pills that are this size. This is how much it's not been paid attention to. But I think there's nothing, you don't really lose anything by paying careful attention to that. You might give a person a good, you know, an advantage in being able to get down to low doses. But, you know, I don't really prescribe antidepressants that much. I mean, I really do work in a different sphere.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, when they came out in the 90s, I was already doing community mental health work, mostly with people with psychosis. And so I saw this big promotion and, I mean, they were so heavily promoted. And I think way beyond what the literature suggested. And they were just thought to be so benign. Like I trained in the era of the tricyclic antidepressants that were not benign drugs, very dangerous, an overdose, you know, a lot of side effects. People weren't like wanting to be on them, but like starting an SSRI is pretty easy. And they were thought to be benign. So like, yeah, so someone's unhappy. Why should people be unhappy? You know, I think the intention was was always a good one.
Yeah. And I know you you work primarily with psychosis, but I was wanting to get your thoughts on ECT.
Yeah, I mean, I you had mentioned that before we talked, and I don't, you know, it's funny, when I, not haha funny, but sort of droll funny, when I finished my residency, I thought there are two things that seem to work, antipsychotic drugs and ECT. And it seemed ECT, I was trained, I gave it, it felt weird, it felt like, you know, super weird. However, I have seen people have very dramatic responses. And, you know, a person not eating, not making any sense, really in an extremely distressed state that can be dangerous. You know, people need to drink fluids and they get, you know, a couple of ECTs and they're a completely different person. I can't ignore that, you know. But as with everything, I mean, I'm certainly aware of the memory problems. I've seen it. It's very popular, you know, and that's, people are not being forced to get ECT, at least not in Vermont. I mean, there's pretty rigorous informed consent, but I've also seen people who use it when I don't think it's working very well. And, you know, because now it's, you know, it doesn't, we've known for a long time, the effects don't last. So now people get maintenance ECT. And then, you know, I see with some people, again, this is my population, which is not, you know, it's not maybe reflective. And that's why I don't generally talk about this. A kind of people coming back to their old baseline, but they perceive it as being useful. And so they're going in week after week. So as with everything, I'm not one that favors banning it. I'm favor informed consent. People should know about memory problems. But I think people should have the dignity of deciding for themselves. I mean, I had one person, this is many, many, many years ago, and I did not really consider this for reasons I don't want to go into because of confidentiality. And then the person sought it out and felt it helpful and was very angry with me that I had never brought it up. And, you know, I know what my reasons were. I think my reasons were legit. I was surprised that it was so effective, but you know, they're just different sides. You know, there are a lot of people out there that think that have been harmed and don't feel like they've gotten informed consent, or you'll read cases of it being forced on people. I mean, that's not something that I've ever been a part of, but I do believe in informed consent. It's just the tricky thing with informed consent is what information that are they getting? And so people can say with all the drugs, like many psychiatrists are not giving the full picture. Like, do psychiatrists talk about the risk of withdrawal, prolonged withdrawal from SSRIs? There's a huge community of people out there who talk about this. There's a lot of them. I've met people. I believe this is a thing. I never heard of it until I got involved with the, you know, the advocacy group and, you know, the Man in America group. And I, you know, so I think that should be part of informed consent. But I think a lot, there's a counter argument saying, we don't think it happens that often and it's going to scare people from getting a helpful treatment. You know, this happens in all of medicine. It's complicated, but
yeah.
I'm not, you know, I'll take the radical stand of saying I'm not in favor of banning it.
Okay. And I guess what would your solution be to, like, with the current state of things, the way that things are currently practiced? And I know there's not any one way, but I guess mainstream medical care for mental health disorders, with the taking into consideration the way that psychiatrists are trained, prescribing practice, pharmaceutical collaboration, you know, what moving forward, what do you think we need to change or pay attention to? Or yeah, what's the path forward?
Well, you know, it's hard. It's complicated. I mean, I'm big on slowing down. You know, I've used this term slow psychiatry. Like, the current system is very fast. Like, you get in there, you get a diagnosis quickly, treatment started quickly. And I, again, good intentions, right? But I think it's hard to get to know a person and understand the complexities of it. I mentioned open dialogue. I think that's just a lovely way to kind of get involved quickly. So when I say slow down, it doesn't mean you're on a wait list for 4 weeks. It's you're talking to someone within 24 to 48 hours. Bringing in the social network is so helpful. Like, what do other people think? It first of all builds in some support. And I think people in the midst of a crisis are often very lonely and isolated. And so trying to find where their natural supports is important. And taking time to have, you know, we've now talked for almost an hour and a half about these drugs. It's not an easy conversation, and to talk about them and to not necessarily rush into a labeling and treatment. But giving a label does something to someone. And I think we need to be pretty cautious about this and humble about what we know and don't know. So that's one thing. I think we need to feed people and house people. I think so many of the problems that we see are related to, you know, social problems and how hard life is. You know, I'm a grandmother and going through that process again and just being reminded, let's say, how tough it is to be a new parent and the stress of it. And, you know, I certainly think we need to pay attention to maternal mental health, and there's a certain risk period. And I've seen women who become psychotic, but I think it's very easy to, it can be easy to move into saying, oh, this person has postpartum depression, as opposed to saying, what can we do to support families and women and, you know, and deal with sleep deprivation and offer help? You know, there are other countries that give people so much more support in those days. That's just like one example, but everything, you know, if you have food insecurity, if you they're just, this is going to have an effect, and, you know, pay attention to that. That of course goes beyond what any psychiatrist can do. So the psychiatrist might say, I can't do anything about this, so I might as well do what I can do. And okay. But I mean, be careful about what you're labeling, because if what you're saying is you live in terrible circumstances, and I know that's contributing to what's going on, I'm going to give you this drug that might take the edge off of it. Okay. But that's a different conversation than saying, oh, you have major depressive disorder. I think people come to think about themselves and not pay attention to these other things. So, you know, that's, it's tough. And, you know, and there are people out there that really, really want psychiatric drugs. And so for me, sometimes I'm in the funny space of saying, you know, I don't think they're going to be that helpful. But, you know, you want to be respectful to everybody and sort of understand what they want and why they want it. And, you know.
Yeah. Can I ask one final question?
Yeah.
What are your, and again, this isn't necessarily in your work purview, but just kind of your thoughts on it. I think what the DSM would call bipolar disorder is a lot of people that I've met talk about if there's, you know, this is one of the diagnoses we have that is has a high genetic component to it. And that's a pretty good sign that if, you know, your mother was bipolar and her mother before that, and then you're showing these symptoms, well, that's a pretty good sign to say that it might go along with you also having bipolar symptom presentation. And I've talked with another person who he's basically all the way psychological, as in these are, when you experience certain painful emotions, you learned a certain style of reacting to them. And the way that you react to painful life circumstances and emotions comes out in this way. And that's all learned. It's all nurtured, basically. But if there is a genetic component, we don't know, is that 1%? Is that 5%? Is that 10%? So there, might as well not even like basically take it into account. So I guess in between that, what are your thoughts
well,
on that?
Well, there's a lot in what you just said. And yeah. And so let me try to parse it out. First of all, psychiatric genetics has ended up being far more complicated than people anticipated back when I was in training. And I'm not going to go into this because I'll do a terrible job of explaining it, but there's a difference, you know, heritability is a complicated concept, and it has to do with sort of a general risk of something being transmitted. It may not apply to at the individual level. And with none of the psychiatric disorders, has there been some sort of clear single gene or something like that? It's some complicated array, multiple genes that each confer a certain kind of risk and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, in the end, let's say, you know, you come from a family where, you know, there have been a few generations of people having bipolar disorder, it's certainly fair to say you're at higher risk, but it doesn't mean you're going to get it or necessarily get it. So that's a whole kind of, you could have a whole multiple podcast on heritability and psychiatric genetics and all that kind of stuff. But we still don't really know, you know, what bipolar disorder is. Now, the second thing is the expansion of the terminology of bipolar disorder that's occurred in the past, you know, 20, 30 years, which I think, you know, I mentioned about the FDA having targets and expanding indications. So, you know, it used to be called manic depressive illness, and then, you know, and that became bipolar one. And then there's a bipolar two where you're mostly depressed, but maybe have a few days of elevated mood. And then there's rapid cycling bipolar disorder where your moods are going all over the place. There's childhood bipolar disorder, and some of the definitions to meet criteria of childhood bipolar disorder really do not require a sustained period of time in, you know, an altered state, an altered mood state. So we've now, you can see how we've really broadened the number of people who might end up getting a label that includes the words bipolar. You know, it's really broad. And so it's hard to talk about such a broad group in any kind of singular way. Now, I do think that there's a condition that fits the old terminology of manic depressive illness that is remarkable. I mean, it can be, it's an awful thing to live with. But to me, it's the hardest thing to understand because someone in a kind of what I'm going to call florid manic episode. So let's say not sleeping for days or weeks at a time, talking so quickly you can't understand them, having delusions of grandeur, and then engaging in, like, you know, very risky behavior, you know, people depleting their bank accounts, traveling, you know, getting themselves in harm's way, you know, landing, you know, very far away in an airport and not making sense and not really having a coherence. This is a condition I've seen. And those people can come out of that and you can have the best psychiatrist in the world talk to them and you wouldn't detect any kind of problem. And that, I got to say, I'm still in awe. Like, what is that? You know? And it does strike me as something going on in the brain because, yeah, it can be triggered by stress. It could be triggered by loss. It can be triggered, you know, and I think I've seen that, you know, and, you know, I can think of someone where there's a strong family history and this person didn't have anything until being, you know, early middle age and experiencing very, very dramatic stress. So, you know, there was kind of an interaction. You don't discount it. But again, some very profoundly altered state occurred. So, but that's really different. Like, I've never thought I felt I had a handle on rapid cycling bipolar disorder, bipolar two, because, you know, someone who's depressed, and then you say to them, looking back, have you ever had a few days where your mood was elevated? I mean, most people with depression will report back. And how do you know whether that's something that's like the normal fluctuations are really in it? And there are people, you know, and rapid cycling. I remember one time I was sitting in my office and this person, I don't mean at all to like discount something, but we have an interview for an hour and I'm not really noticing anything. And at the end of the person said, I cycled 20 times during the course of this. I was like, oh, okay. I mean, that's just all I can say is I don't know what it is, but uh-huh. that's so different in sort of presentation from someone in the midst of a very, you know, classic manic episode, which I do believe exists based on my own experience. Hmm. So, I mean, your question for me had a lot of complexity to it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I certainly think that, you know, mood, we all have moods, you know, we all have moods and they vary, and parsing it out into what's this extreme thing and not, you know, once you start adding these categories, but I tell you, I don't think you need to be trained to pick out someone in a manic episode. There's this wonderful psychiatrist, he's died, and his name is Mickey Nardo, and he wrote a blog called One Boring Old Man, which is still out there. I highly recommend it. And he would call this a showstopper. And it was a way to say, yeah, there's certain things that I think are like brain problems. And it's like, yeah. I always like kept that in my head.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know if that answered your query, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the nuance there. Well, Dr. Steingard, thank you for joining us today. And thank you. It's been very helpful talking with you today, trying to get a lot of these thoughts and things better understood and better figured out. So I appreciate it.
Great. It was lovely to meet you. Thanks for doing. I feel like your podcast is similar to like what I did with blogs, like your way of trying to work it out and make sense of it. And that's what it was for me as well. And it was helpful. Writing for me was a way to like put my thoughts down and get them clarified. So I appreciate what you're doing here.
Oh yeah. That's a nice parallel.
All right.